From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Washington says it has captured a key suspect in a 2012 terrorist attack that killed its ambassador to Libya. We'll find out why Britain is reopening its embassy in Iran after a three-year closure. Ukrainian activists who helped to oust their pro-Russian president earlier this year now want a change of parliament. And we'll take you inside the bars of New York City as its diverse immigrant communities cheer for their teams in the World Cup. Those stories and more in the next 30 minutes. I'm Michael Lippin. The United States says it has captured a key suspect in a 2012 terrorist assault on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, Libya. The attack killed U.S. Ambassador Christopher Stevens and three other Americans. The Defense Department said Tuesday that a special operations unit detained Ahmed Abu Qatala on Sunday near Benghazi. U.S. officials say he is being held aboard a U.S. naval ship for interrogation. President Barack Obama said Qatala will be brought to the United States to stand trial and face the full weight of the American justice system. Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, the top U.S. diplomat at the time of the Benghazi attack, said on CNN television that she is still looking for answers to how it happened. She called the incident a confusing and difficult time and expressed hope that Qatala's arrest will reveal who was behind the attack and what the motivations were. Republicans accuse Clinton, a possible Democratic presidential candidate, of failing to provide adequate security to the U.S. diplomats in Benghazi when she was Secretary of State. The Obama administration in which she served first said the attack was related to protests about an anti-Muslim video. It later acknowledged that terrorists were behind the assault. U.S. Vice President Joe Biden says Iraq clearly needs urgent assistance in dealing with an Islamist insurgency that has taken over large parts of the country's north. Biden made the comment on Tuesday during a visit to Brazil. He did not specify what urgent assistance the United States will provide to Iraq. In the country's latest fighting, Iraqi officials say a militant assault on a government prison in the city of Bakuba led to the deaths of at least 44 prisoners. It was not clear who killed the detainees. In an interview with VOA's Kurdish service, Iraqi Foreign Minister Hoshyar Zebari called the Sunni militant insurgency the biggest threat facing the Shiite-led Iraqi government. While those rapid gains by Sunni militants in Iraq are provoking widespread concerns among U.S. lawmakers of both major political parties, VOA correspondent Michael Bowman has the latest reaction from the U.S. Senate.
The situation requires an urgent U.S. response, according to Republican Senator Mitch McConnell.
The administration must act quickly to provide assistance to the Maliki government before every gain made by the U.S. and allied troops is lost, and before ISIL expands its sanctuary from which it can eventually threaten the United States.
But McConnell, like most U.S. lawmakers, is not saying precisely what the Obama administration should do. Such caution is no surprise, says political scientist John Mueller, who spoke via Skype.
I think they being vague is they don't know what to do. One alternative, of course, is to give up, and no one seems to want to say that, so they have to huff and puff and pretend they're on to do something. Mostly what will happen probably be very little, and in a situation that seems disastrous.
Michael Bowman, VOA News, the Capitol.
Britain has announced that it will reopen its embassy in Iran 3 years after closing it in response to an attack on the building by Iranian protesters. Tuesday's decision is the latest move by a Western nation to improve relations with Iran as the crisis in neighboring Iraq intensifies. VOA's Al Pessin reports from London.
British Foreign Secretary William Hague made the announcement in Parliament.
We will be reopening our embassy in Tehran. Initially, this will be with a small diplomatic team, but it is an important step forward in our bilateral relations with Iran.
Hague said Iran will also likely reopen its embassy in London. The Foreign Secretary said Britain would use the increased diplomatic contact in part to press Iran to end what he called its support for sectarian groups. That was an apparent reference to Iraq, where Iran supports the Shiite government and other groups that the West has accused of alienating Sunnis and fueling support for Sunni extremist groups. One of those groups, the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant, has taken control of several Iraqi cities during the past week and has advanced to within 65 kilometers of Baghdad. The crisis has put Iran in the spotlight and got this comment on Yahoo News from U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry.
We're open to discussions if there's something constructive that can be contributed by Iran, if Iran is prepared to do something that is going to respect the integrity and sovereignty of Iraq and the ability of the government to reform.
One result was a brief high-level meeting between senior U.S. and Iranian officials to discuss Iraq on Monday in Vienna, where the two countries are the key players in talks on the future of Iran's nuclear program. State Department spokeswoman Jen Psaki noted that U.S. officials have spoken with Iran on other issues in recent years, including the situation in Afghanistan. She characterized Monday's meeting this way.
We're not talking about coordinating any military action in Iraq with Iran. We would encourage Iran to push the Iraqis to act to address problems in a non-sectarian way.
But that has not been Iran's policy so far. It supported militant Shiite groups fighting U.S. and other international forces during Iraq's civil war. More recently, Iran has backed the increasingly sectarian Shiite Iraqi government. At the Maplecroft risk assessment firm, analyst Torbjorn Soltvedt says the U.S. and British approaches to Iran show how concerned they are about the advance of the Sunni militants in Iraq, but he says it carries considerable risks.
You could envision a situation where Sunni civilian populations could be killed in attacks carried out either by militias backed by Iran or even by Revolutionary Guard forces themselves. And in that kind of scenario, then the already bad sectarian tensions in Iraq could get even worse.
U.S. and British officials have stressed that they will urge Iran to take the opposite course and push their Iraqi allies to moderate their sectarian tendencies. But it's not clear whether Iran sees that as being in its interest. Some analysts warn Iran might prefer the breakup of Iraq with a militant Sunni entity in the west, the Kurdish enclave in the north, and a weakened government in Baghdad struggling to control the rest of the country. Al Pessin, VOA News, London.
Israel is stepping up a crackdown on Palestinian militant group Hamas. The Israeli government accuses Hamas of kidnapping three Israeli teenage boys in the West Bank last week, but there has been no claim of responsibility for their disappearance. On Tuesday, the Israeli army announced the arrests of about 40 Palestinians in overnight raids, bringing the total number detained to more than 200 since the Israeli teens disappeared. Israeli cabinet ministers also agreed to further increase pressure on Hamas. Israeli military spokesman Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner said, "As long as our boys remain abducted, Hamas will feel pursued, paralyzed, and threatened." Egypt has freed an Al Jazeera journalist after jailing him for 10 months without charge. Abdullah El-Shami had been on hunger strike since January to protest his detention. Egyptian prosecutors ordered his release for health reasons. Witnesses say the once robust El-Shami looked frail as he walked out of a Cairo police station on Tuesday. Police arrested him last August as he covered a protest by supporters of ousted Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi. Al Jazeera is demanding that Egypt free another three of its journalists who were jailed in the country for allegedly spreading false news. Well, it's time for a short break on International Edition, but when we come back, Thailand tries to persuade Cambodian workers who recently fled the country to come back.
Put your flags up in the sky. Hi, this is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Visit VOAfootball.com for live updates on the World Cup in Brazil. The site is optimized for your mobile phone or tablet and will bring you the latest scores, stats, photos, and videos. And everything can be shared with your friends from your mobile device to Facebook and Twitter. World Cup nonstop at VOAfootball.com.
A top Chinese diplomat is in Vietnam for the first high-level meeting between the two countries since Beijing's recent deployment of an oil rig in disputed waters of the South China Sea. Chinese State Councilor Yang Jiechi is scheduled to have talks on Wednesday with Vietnamese Foreign Minister Pan Binh Minh. Yang also is expected to meet Vietnam's Prime Minister Nguyen Tan Dung. A Vietnamese Foreign Ministry spokesman said the two sides will discuss the issue of the controversial Chinese oil rig. China deployed the rig on May 1st, sparking violent anti-China riots in Vietnam, where at least five people were killed and hundreds more were injured. British satellite company Inmarsat says authorities searching for a missing Malaysian passenger plane have not yet searched what it believes is the most likely crash site. Authorities recently finished an unsuccessful two-month-long search of 850 square kilometers of the southern Indian Ocean. On Tuesday, an Inmarsat official said an Australian vessel involved in the search originally headed toward a possible crash site determined by one of its communication satellites. But the official said the ship was distracted by signals thought to be from the missing jet's black box. The Malaysia Airlines Boeing 777 was headed from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing on March 8th when it disappeared with 239 people on board. Thai officials said Tuesday they will welcome back Cambodian workers who re-enter the country legally. The statement follows a mass Cambodian exodus from Thailand in recent weeks, driven by rumors of a Thai military crackdown on undocumented workers. A Cambodian foreign ministry spokesman told VOA's Khmer service that Thai authorities will allow the workers to return under certain conditions. Spokesman Khoi Kwong said Thai authorities want Cambodian workers to carry legal documentation so that they avoid becoming victims of human trafficking or labor exploitation. A representative of the International Organization for Migration, Joe Lowry, told VOA that his group also is monitoring the situation of other migrant groups in Thailand.
We have not heard of any large-scale or even small-scale movement of migrant workers from Myanmar or Laos out of the country. At the moment, the main mass movement appears to be among Cambodians.
Well, more than 400,000 Cambodians were thought to be working in Thailand before the Thai military staged a coup last month. The Kremlin says Russian President Vladimir Putin has spoken by phone with his Ukrainian counterpart Petro Poroshenko about a possible ceasefire in southeastern Ukraine. The top-level discussion is only the second known direct contact between the leaders of the two countries since Russia annexed Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula in March. Pro-Russian separatists have since mounted a rebellion in Ukraine's east, and Moscow has cut off natural gas supplies to its neighbor in a dispute about unpaid debts. A Kremlin spokesman says Mr. Putin also expressed concern to Mr. Poroshenko about the killings of two Russian state journalists near the Ukrainian city of Luhansk on Tuesday. Regional news reports say the journalists were killed when their car was hit by mortar fire near Luhansk, which is held by pro-Russian rebels. Well, Ukrainian protesters gathered outside the nation's parliament on Tuesday as it held its first full session since Mr. Poroshenko was sworn in. The crowd of thousands of students, anti-Russian activists, and ordinary residents say the revolution that ousted the old pro-Russian president was just a first step. VOA's Anita Powell reports from the protest in Kyiv.
Ukraine's revolution was supposed to have ended in February with the ouster of pro-Russian President Viktor Yanukovych. But 4 months later, activists in the capital say those violent confrontations in central Kyiv were just the beginning of the transformation of this Eastern European nation. Protesters got the new president they sought, the Europe-friendly Petro Poroshenko. He was elected in May and sworn in earlier this month. But protesters say changing the president was just the beginning. They want a new parliament because they say the current one is corrupt. This protester, who gave his name only as Mikhail, said the new president is just window dressing over a bigger problem. We have a new president, he said, but it is not only about him. There are no changes. They are not making any decisions. Irina Shlatyochenko was among the protesters in February. She says her demands are still unmet. Yanukovych is gone, she said, but in the courts and other administrations, we still have his lapdogs. But university student Oleg Mikchuk says the nation has enough to think about right now without having an election. We are against the parliament dissolution, he said. This is not a very good time for us because of the war. The country is not united, so not everyone will be able to vote. Ukraine remains at war, Russia has annexed the Crimean Peninsula, and Ukraine accuses Moscow of supporting violent separatists who have seized several major towns, including Slovyansk and Donetsk. Radical Member of Parliament Oleg Lyashko, who challenged Mr. Poroshenko for the presidency, says voters should have a chance to re-elect him. He is critical of some of his colleagues. He says today, when Ukrainian soldiers are getting killed, these chair warmers want a vacation. He says they should be kicked in the ass and dragged to Slovyansk. Let them dig foxholes in Slovyansk for a vacation. Parts of central Kyiv still look like a war zone, with burned out cars and makeshift tents in the city's main square. But the city is trying to return things to normal, and have put municipal workers to the task of replacing the paving stones that protesters tore up to make barricades. But it may be some time before Ukraine is put back together. Anita Powell, VOA News, Kyiv.
U.S. President Obama says he will expand the protection of marine life in the Central Pacific Ocean, putting more than 2 million square kilometers off limits to fishing, energy exploration, and recreation. VOA's Jessica Berman has the details.
President Obama unveiled his plan Tuesday to create what could become the world's largest marine preserve. He spoke by video message to attendees of an oceans conference in Washington, hosted by the U.S. State Department.
If we drain our oceans of their resources, we won't just be squandering one of humanity's greatest treasures. We'll be cutting off one of the world's major sources of food and economic growth, including for the United States, and we cannot afford to let that happen.
The president said he intends to use his executive power to create the massive ocean sanctuary, which would greatly expand the Pacific Remote Islands Marine National Monument, created by his predecessor, George W. Bush. The preserve would extend protection to waters around seven remote atolls and islands near Hawaii and controlled by the United States. Last week, President Obama issued an order limiting the amount of carbon dioxide, a greenhouse gas, that power plants may pump into the atmosphere.
Today, I'm building on that progress by directing the federal government to create a national strategy to combat black market fishing that threatens our oceans, undermines our economy, and often supports dangerous criminals.
It's expected that President Obama's executive action to protect the underwater Pacific will run into vigorous opposition from members of the deep-sea fishing industry, including anglers who catch tuna, as well as some members of Congress. Republican Congressman Doc Hastings of Washington State called the zoning proposal a unilateral action by an imperial president to impose new regulations and restrictions on economic activities, including fishing, recreation, and energy production. Hastings, who heads the House Natural Resources Committee, accuses the president of blatant disregard for possible economic consequences. The Pacific Ocean Sanctuary Plan could go into effect later this year following a public comment period. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Well, New York City is home to ethnic and immigrant communities that have passionate supporters for their national soccer teams in the World Cup. VOA's Adam Phillips went to some local bars and restaurants to find out how Mexican, Brazilian, and German fans express that support.
It was game one of the FIFA World Cup 2014, and Miss Favela, a Brazilian bar in Brooklyn, was packed with Brazilian Americans and expats rooting for a goal against Croatia. It was not long in coming. At halftime, Giuliana Marcucci smiled approvingly as some countrymen climbed on tables to dance. She said that more than mere sport was at work in the revelry.
It's sort of a religion for Brazilians. It represents our faith in our country. Even if you have some troubles, as we are having right now, you still believe on it because it's part of you.
The next day, at Tortilleria Nixtamal, a Mexican restaurant in Queens, waitress Marilyn Estrada was ecstatic that her country had just defeated Cameroon.
I feel really, really happy because we won our first game in the FIFA World Cup, 1-0, so that's exciting. You know, it represents Mexico as a strong country that we could win this World Cup. Yeah, we could go all the way. Viva Mexico!
Soon, two Mexican-American amigos, Pedro and Diego, were riding a subway all the way into Manhattan to watch Spain play the Netherlands while savoring Mexico's victory.
The best moment was when, we got that goal and that definite score, being that, we already had some chances and we couldn't get it in there, but we got the job done and that's what matters. Luckily, the goalie saved us because, we were about to get scored on. He flew in the air and...
You think it's going to go all the way?
Oh, yeah, of course. We're hoping for the best, but the Fanatics.
It was beer and bratwurst at Lorelei, a Brauhaus-style beer garden where a mostly German crowd had just watched its national team score yet another goal against Portugal. Cologne-born Michael Mom owns the place and was delighted by this.
Fantastic. Actually, much better than I expected. Germany is always nervous before we start, but we are definitely a championship team. You know, we always rise to the occasion.
Nicole Weick, a Berliner, sat nearby. She wore a white German football jersey adorned with three stars, one for each World Cup championship win.
We're here to get our fourth star. As a German, we are fevering for the game since forever, and so we have to watch every game, even on vacation.
Steven Gilardi, Nicole's American husband, seems similarly pro-Deutsch.
In a couple of weeks when they play the U.S., I'll be on the other side of the rooting team, but it's great to be fans with both teams, and it's kind of just a way of building a community for a very short period of time, for essentially the 90-minute duration of the game, but everyone's like one family at that time, just enjoying the game.
There are dozens of games left to enjoy before the FIFA World Cup 2014 ends in mid-July. Yet, given the joy these many national groups in this most international of cities are expressing, a nonpartisan might well wish them all success. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
Well, in Tuesday's World Cup action, Mexico held the host and favorite Brazil to a draw in an entertaining match at Castelão Arena in the city of Fortaleza. Brazil repeatedly failed to penetrate a stubborn defense backed up by Mexico's goalie Guillermo Ochoa. The draw brought an end to Brazil's 10-match winning streak dating back to August. Also Tuesday, Belgian substitutes scored two late goals to lift Belgium to a 2-1 win over Algeria in the Europeans' first World Cup match in 12 years. And Russia and South Korea played to a 1-1 draw at the Pantanal Arena in Cuiaba. South Korea took the lead in the 68th minute when the Russian goalie mishandled a shot from Lee Kyun-ho. But Russia's Alexander Kurzakov bailed out his side by scoring a goal a few minutes later after coming on as a substitute. Well, a stamp that was worth just a penny when it was made has just sold for $9.5 million. That's the price the incredibly rare postage stamp from the former British colony of Guyana fetched at an auction in New York on Tuesday, a world record price for a stamp. The tiny octagon-shaped stamp was printed in 1856 in black ink on magenta paper. Aside from being one of the only surviving relics from Guyana's colonial past, the stamp has a long history of unusual ownership. They include a French count, a German museum, and an American millionaire. Well, that's a wrap of International Edition on The Voice of America. Your studio director today was Tracy Carter, and the engineer was Jimmy Cook. I'm Michael Lippin. We'll see you next time.
This is Today in History. On June 18, 1429, French and English forces clashed in the Battle of Patay, part of the Hundred Years' War for control of France. French cavalry attacked and overwhelmed the English troops. On this day in 1812, President James Madison signed a declaration of war against Britain. Lasting for more than 2 years, the War of 1812 was caused by the British blockade of France that had an adverse impact on U.S. trade. Other U.S. grievances against the British included their support for hostile Indian tribes and their impressment or seizure of American seamen. In 1815, Napoleon was defeated at the Battle of Waterloo by British, German, and Dutch forces. The Battle of Waterloo ended French domination of Europe and resulted in boundary changes on that continent. In 1877, American artist and illustrator James Montgomery Flagg was born. He was best known for the World War I era recruitment poster of Uncle Sam pointing and saying, "I want you for the U.S. Army." On this day in 1940, Italian leader Benito Mussolini arrived in Munich to discuss plans with German dictator Adolf Hitler. Mussolini wanted Hitler to demand the total surrender of France and the occupation of the southern portion of France that was still technically free. Hitler refused. Also in 1940, Free French leader Charles de Gaulle addressed his countrymen by radio, urging them to resist Nazi occupation. On the same day, British Prime Minister Winston Churchill addressed the House of Commons and urged his countrymen to prepare for the Battle of Britain. In 1948, the UN Commission on Human Rights adopted the International Declaration of Human Rights. That's it for today. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant has continued to terrorize the Iraqi people. While we understand that ISIL's southward advance has slowed, we have also seen reports that it has made gains in areas along the Syrian border. There are also reports of a large-scale massacre in the recently seized city of Tikrit. ISIL claims to have massacred 1,700 Iraqi Shia Air Force recruits. U.S. State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki called the alleged mass shooting horrifying and a true depiction of the bloodlust that these terrorists represent. While the United States cannot yet confirm these reports, one of the primary goals of ISIL is to set fear into the hearts of all Iraqis and drive sectarian division among its people. The U.S. condemns these tactics in the strongest possible terms and stands in solidarity with the Iraqi people against these horrendous and senseless acts of violence. Terrorists who can commit such heinous acts are a shared enemy of the United States, Iraq, and the international community. This underscores the need for Iraqi leaders from across the political spectrum to take steps that unify the country in the face of this threat. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry emphasized the importance of Iraqi leaders adhering to its constitutionally mandated time frame for forming a new government and respecting the rights of all citizens, Sunni, Kurd, and Shia, as it fights against terrorism. The United States is reaching out to the international community and Iraq's regional neighbors to emphasize the threat that Iraq and the region are under from ISIL and the importance of coming to Iraq's aid at this critical juncture. President Barack Obama is examining a range of options that could help the Iraqi security forces push back on ISIL advances. The United States will do its part to help Iraq move beyond this crisis, and the U.S. urges all Iraqis to unite against this violence and continue to reject the path of hatred that ISIL represents.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.